This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about protecting your plants from winter on the show today. Diana Alfuth is back with us. She's a retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. How can we help you with your gardening questions? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Diana.
Hey, Jill, how are you doing?
I am great. How's the weather up in your area?
Today we have sun. It's chilly. Yay. It's only like 38 degrees, but after two foggy, wet, gloomy days, any kind of sunshine is such a nice relief to see.
Yeah, we're a little bit more cloudy down here in the Madison area, but the sun really makes a difference. But, you know, winter is coming. So
it is. And the forecast has nice weather for through this week and the next few days. And then the bottom falls out over Thanksgiving, according to the forecast I've seen anyway. So, you know, those last few gardening tasks, this might be the weekend to do them.
Yep. I think I finally have to get my bulbs in the ground. I have been procrastinating. Oh my gosh. I'm just terrible. So, so one of the things, go right ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, one year I actually used an axe to chop through 2 inches of frozen soil and stuck bulbs in, and they did bloom in spring just in time for the deer to come and nip the tulip heads off.
Oh, so, how nice.
So you're good yet.
Yeah. Maybe Mother Nature was trying to tell you that you shouldn't be planting those because the deer was going to eat them. I did the same thing with daffodils up in my place in the UP, and they grew. They absolutely grew, so... You know, you got to do what you got to do. But some of the things that we can do, still do right now, is cut back our perennials. What are some of the reasons why we should or shouldn't do that?
Yeah, so that's, you know, there's nothing cut and dried about gardening, right? There are pros and cons to everything, and there are reasons you should do it and reasons you might not want to do it. So one of the things that I find is that people, especially newer gardeners or whatever, they don't know. And they go, oh, my gosh, do I need to cut this back? Is it going to die if I don't cut it back and that kind of thing? And so first, I just want everybody to relax and procrastinate. the thing is that if you don't cut anything back this fall, nothing's going to die. Okay. So if you think of a plant growing in the wild, nobody comes along and cuts it off. Right.
Right.
So when in doubt, don't cut it back because, you know, it'll live and you can deal with it later. But there are some reasons to cut some things back. The first would be if you had diseased plants. So foliage that had powdery mildew or septoria leaf spot or something like that on it, you don't want that foliage out there breaking apart and those spores, those diseases overwintering. So get that kind of stuff out of there. The other reason that most people cut things back is that they like the looks of it rather than looking at dead stalks or dead leaves or whatever all winter. They like the neatness of it. But on the other hand, leaving some of those flower heads up is great for birds over the winter. I like to leave up purple coneflower seed heads, black-eyed Susan seed heads, liatris, because once the snow blanket comes and those are sticking up above the snow, I see finches and other birds sitting on them eating the seeds all year long. So that's a reason to leave them up. The other thing is some beneficial insects will overwinter in those standing stems, especially hollow stems. The flip side to that is that pest insects can also find nice little homes in those places. So if you've had a problem with a pest insect over the summer, you should really look up that insect, look at where it wants to overwinter, and make sure that you're not providing habitat for it the next year. Again, with perennials, it's kind of up to you. Now, I would not cut back some of the lower growing things like coral bells or the lower growing sedums. There's not really a major reason to cut those back. In spring, once the snow melts, if we get snow, which we haven't had a lot of the last couple of years, you know, the leaves will be dry and on the ground and you can easily pick them up. I wouldn't cut back coral bells because they have a crown that likes to protrude above the ground, and those coral bell leaves help to protect them over winter. So things like that, they're easy to clean up in spring. And whether or not you decide to cut things back this fall, let's say you don't, well, then in spring, everything that's dead is going to be dead and dry and easy to snap off and pick up. And once you see what's growing, getting new shoots and stuff, you just remove everything else, everything that's dead, and you clear it out of there. So it's kind of like you planting your bulbs. If you have time to clean up in the fall, and I would always clean up in the fall because I know that my springtime is super, super busy and I don't get the time to get out there. But that's kind of just a personal thing, you know, and what works best for everybody.
Well, and we've talked about this back and forth, you know, for the last few years, is like, do we leave them for the critters? Do we cut them all back? I think it adds a lot of interest to the garden by leaving it. But then we know I'm a lazy gardener, so.
I agree. I like to see, you know, especially like those frosty days where the frost clings to everything. It's just really neat to look at that frost on a you know, a dead seed head or whatever. And but not everybody likes that. Not everybody likes looking at dead brown plants, you know. And so it's each his own. You know, there's not one thing you have to or don't have to do. But when it comes to cutting back, if you're in doubt, don't.
Right.
Because you're more likely to do damage, and not so much to perennials, because they all die back to the ground anyway over winter. But if you're talking about things like shrubs or something like that, if you're not sure if you should cut it back, don't. And then in spring, once growth starts, you cut away anything that's dead and leave the new growth, the new green stuff.
Well, we'll talk about some specifics in a little bit, but we've got Lester in Madison with a question. Go ahead, Lester.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I was curious about what to do with my raspberry plants. Specifically, should I cut the floricanes? What do I do with the primacanes, to be real specific?
Okay, so the first question is, do you have fall-bearing or summer-bearing or ever-bearing raspberries? Do you know?
I have ever-bearing.
Okay, so there are different methods that you can use, but as you say, there with raspberries, each cane lives for 2 years. The first year, it's a primacane, where it basically just produces leaves. The second year, it grows some more, and it produces flowers and fruits, and then that cane dies. So pruning raspberries is simple yet complicated.
Well, thanks, Diana.
Yeah, right. And it also goes back to one of those things that it depends on how you want to do it, right? So if you don't mind your raspberries all coming later in the season, you could just mow the whole patch off. But technically, what you would want to do is prune out anything that flowered this year. So any of the floricanes from this year, because they're going to die anyway. They're not going to produce anymore. And then the primacanes, you should thin out. Usually you think about one or two canes left per square foot, just so that you will get better air circulation and that sort of a thing. And you can whack the tips off of the ones that you leave behind. That'll cause those canes to branch next year when they start growing, and then you get more flowering and fruiting tips. But you thin out the primacanes so that your patch doesn't become too much of a jungle. And that's, you know, there are books on pruning raspberries, but that's the nutshell kind of a thing. Anything that fruited, get rid of there, thin out what's left, and nip the tips off of others. A lot of people will cut the tops off of the primacanes that will be next year's floricanes at like 2 feet high. And again, it's kind of to control the jungle.
Yeah, because you certainly don't want to let it go because it's such a mess. Oh, my gosh.
And depending on your variety, some of those canes, you know, they get over your head and then they, you know, they tangle and everything else. So yeah. Keeping them a little bit under control.
Okay. Well, thanks for the question, Lester. Does the Learning Store from UW have a PDF on pruning raspberries?
You know, since I retired, I'm not as up to date on what they have. But yes, if you Google UW Extension growing raspberries in Wisconsin, there is a really, really extensive publication on raspberries, including pruning, but also pests and diseases and care and all that sort of a thing. So just Google UW Extension growing raspberries in Wisconsin, and you should be able to find it.
Okay. All right. Let's go to John in La Crosse. Go right ahead, John.
Hi. We have a red bush in our yard. It's really beautiful, bright red. It's about 8 foot tall, and it has bright red leaves, and later it gets some little round seeds that cardinals love to eat. And but we want to make that bush shorter again. Used to be about 3 foot tall. Now it's 8 foot tall. Can I trim it down this fall?
Probably. So the one question that I don't have is exactly what it is, because we have a lot of red bush. So does this get the bright red color late in the fall, but during the summer it's green?
No, only late in the fall.
Okay, so it may very well be a burning bush then, a euonymus, and they tend to have one main trunk, but then a lot of stems come out near the base off of that trunk. So yes, you can prune it back right now. What we don't like to see is to just like shear it straight off like a flat top haircut, okay, because then what will happen is each of those branches will branch next year, and then you get this really, really thick top that shades out the center and stuff. So yes, you can go ahead and prune it in the fall. You know, ideally, we always say to prune woody plants, shrubs and stuff during winter or like in March, because right now, especially in the southern part of the state, the plants are still sending all the energy that they formed in the leaves down to the roots to store for winter. And that process is still going on, even though we don't see it. And it's not until like mid-December-ish that all that stuff gets down there. So theoretically, if you prune it before that, you're pruning away some energy that would otherwise go to the roots. Having said that, that's not going to kill the plant.
Right.
It's going to be fine. So if you have the time and the weather's nice right now and stuff, you can go ahead and do it. But try to prune it not like a flat top, but look at each branch that's sticking up there and prune it back to a point where it connects with a bigger branch, okay, so that you have, like, in the end, an uneven pruning kind of a thing. And the rule of thumb is to don't remove more than a third of the plant at a time. So you could go ahead and whack that back and get it down to like maybe 5 feet this year. And then next year you can do that again and kind of shorten it some more, and you can get it back to a smaller plant. But yeah, you can go ahead and prune it now.
I think that one of the benefits of doing it in the winter is that the leaves are gone, and so it's a little bit easier to see what you're doing. So,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I don't know where things are at down in Milwaukee and Madison. You know, up here, we've still got a few leaves hanging on, you know,
oh, yeah,
frozen leaves hanging on shrubs and stuff. So it is still hard to see the inner workings of a shrub.
Yeah, and I've got most of my shrubs still have their leaves. So I think
okay. That's,
for here, it definitely is. And before someone calls, just as a reminder, burning bush is an invasive plant. So
right,
think about
right. Maybe
replacing them, or, you know, just keep that in mind too.
Right. And there are different varieties
yes. That,
you know, are more or less of an issue. But generally speaking, right, we don't like burning bush anymore because they are escaping into woods and stuff. So again, I'm assuming this caller's plant is a burning bush, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Just as, because I know someone's going to call and remind us. Right. So I'm going to do that to save you the energy.
Good cat.
All right. Well, we're talking with Diana Allfuth today. She's a retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. What gardening questions are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Next week on the show, we'll hear from foraging expert Sam Thayer. And then we'll have a special broadcast from Points North. It'll feature stories of Native American endurance, endurance of language, of fishing rights, and of crops. Now, that's for Friday. If you're listening to this on Saturday, we will replay a show that Larry did about chocolate a while back. It's really interesting. So you'll get both choices. But right now we're going to go back to Diana Allfuth. We've got a caller on the line. Jody in Brookline. Brookline, go right ahead.
Hi, good morning. My questions, two different topics. One, we've planted bulbs here, snow glories and the little grape hyacinths that haven't done all that well for kind of a naturalized look. I'm wondering if there can be anything applied now on the top, if it's too late. We've had them in for several years and we just added 300 more this year. And also, how do you prune or care for Annabelle hydrangeas so they don't droop?
Okay, a couple of great questions there. Go ahead, Diana.
All right, can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so first the little bulbs. I would say no, there's not really anything to put on them at this time of year. Typically, we would put on bulb fertilizer maybe like early spring when they're doing their flush of growth, and that's when they're using it mostly. But I will also say that getting those little bulbs that you mentioned to naturalize is not always as easy as it's made out to be. Part of it might be your soil. If you have a heavier soil, they don't seem to do as well. If you have a dry soil, they don't seem to like that. If it's a sandy soil, so they're kind of picky. And I will say that mine didn't start to naturalize until 18 years after I planted them. And then all of a sudden, poof, they were everywhere. I know, weird, right? You know, you might do a soil test to see if there's anything in particular missing. You know, we usually think about phosphorus and potassium for bulb fertilizers. It also depends on if you have any competition. So if you're naturalizing them in mulch area, that's one thing. If it's in grass, the grass is very competitive with them. But maybe start with a soil test and see if there's anything missing that way. Check the pH of the soil and start with that. But otherwise, I get that soil test now and then put any kind of fertilizer on in early spring as soon as the ground thaws out. The Annabelle hydrangeas, you and everyone else has that problem because, you know, those plants were bred to have those big, beautiful flowers, but they're heavy. So one thing to make sure is that do not fertilize your Annabelle hydrangeas because nitrogen will cause faster and weaker stem growth and more foliage. And really what you want in your Annabelles is shorter, stockier plants with, you know, thicker stems and stuff that can better support that. Sometimes lighting, Annabelles actually, you know, we grow them in shade a lot, but a lot of times they're stockier and stronger. The more light they get, the more sunlight they get. If they get, you know, good morning sun, especially. Otherwise, there's not much you can do other than maybe put up around the base of it, like a peony cage, you know, a circular support that's going to be, you know, 2 feet up and hold the stems all up that high. And that might help them to keep from flopping. But otherwise, that is a continuing challenge.
It is.
So, no great answer for you. Sorry.
Although I kind of like them when they're flappy. They just have a different look in the garden. And I know it can be kind of frustrating, but sometimes we have to embrace those things, right?
Right. That's how the plant wants to grow.
That's right. Jay emailed us and was interested to find out what are the water needs of trees going into winter, especially the ones that were just planted this year.
I am so, so glad you asked that because I really, really wanted to mention that. We are super dry across the state right now. The latest drought monitor, I didn't see it yesterday. It usually comes out on Thursdays, but parts of the state are definitely in drought and others are at least dry. So the ground is not frozen yet. If you unhooked your hose, hook it back up and water things. Absolutely, it's dry. And perennials, yes, but especially if you planted any new woody plants this year, get out there and soak them and soak them once a week until the ground freezes because it is serious out there. We do not want plants going into winter dry, especially evergreens. So anything you planted this year, get out and soak. Anything you planted last year, get out and soak because it really takes about 3 years for a tree or shrub to be fully established and have a big enough root system. And anything else within the range of your hose, even if you planted it 4 years ago, it's not going to hurt to soak it. It's really, really important. We need these plants, especially anything that's evergreen, to be juicy going into winter because those drying winter winds and that sun on them, once the ground freezes, the plants cannot take up water to replace what's left. And then we get dieback and we get browning on evergreens. So thank you so much for asking that question. When we're done here today, everybody go out and water your plants.
How do you judge how much is enough?
That's really a hard thing to say because everybody has different water pressure in that. But remember that a tree or shrub, the roots grow out. They don't necessarily grow down. So make sure that you're not watering only at the trunk area, but water beyond the drip line of the shrub. And what you can do is water that area and stuff, and then take a little spade with you. And after a while, just kind of slide that spade in and push it back and make sure that it's wet at least 4 inches down. So the majority of the trees in shrubs roots, they're in the top, 12 inches of the soil. So you don't have to, water 6 feet down, but you do need to water at least 4 inches down. And then that'll continue to work its way down and get to that root system. At this point in time, more is better than less because you want it really well soaked. And next week, when it's in the 30s, the ground's going to start to freeze. So you're going to lose your opportunity. So really get those plants soaked now.
So now, if we will get thawing periods, I don't think that's a question anymore. Should we water during those times if the ground isn't completely frozen?
If you have it soaked well before the first freeze, it's probably not necessary because when that ground is frozen, it's not, you're not losing that water then.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
And that's another great reason to be using mulch. Okay. If you soak and you've got mulch on top, that's not going to evaporate out and the plants aren't growing. So they're only, if they're not active, so they're not using a lot of water. Right. But we want them plumped up and well hydrated now because they won't be active. They won't be pulling more water up. So as long as you get them well soaked before the ground freezes, you don't need to be watering in January.
Sounds good to me. Brianne in Whitewater, go right ahead with your question.
Hi, I have a Korean spice viburnum right next to my side door, and I've been very lazy about pruning it. It's now like encroaching on the walkway, and I'm wondering how best and when to prune it back so that I get the nice, yummy flowers in the spring.
So that's similar to, we just talked about that euonymus. You can go ahead and whack it back now to be able to, you know, get up and down your stairs or through your walkway or whatever. The thing is, again, prune, you know, selectively prune individual, the biggest, tallest ones, prune them back to where they connect to another branch, so that you get a nice natural shape. Korean spice viburnum, I believe, doesn't, and I should really double check this, but I don't think it forms its flower buds until spring. So typically, you know, we don't like to prune spring flowering shrubs now because like things like lilacs and forsythia, they form their flower buds last August and September. So if you prune anything now, you're pruning away some flowers. But if it's something that blooms later in the summer, they often don't form their flower buds until spring and early summer. So then pruning them now is just fine. If you prune away some flowers, yes, you don't get as many flowers next year, but it's not going to hurt the plant overall. So if you have to prune something that flowers in spring now or over winter, that's just fine. Again, it's not going to hurt the overall health of the plant. But selectively pruning the worst of it now will, you know, give you at least some flowers on spring flowering shrubs. You just might not have as many. But yeah, you can go ahead. And again, you know, we really like that rule of a third. Don't plant prune away more than a third of a plant at a time, because that's just a lot of stress for the plant. It'd be like, if we whack off one of your arms, your system will, you know, go into stress. If we whack off both, it's even worse, right?
Interesting analogy, Diana. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Maybe not.
Brianna, we appreciate your call. We got an email from Jess in Fort Atkinson. Now, apparently there's a gooseberry in their yard. Not quite sure. It says that she or he planted it last summer, but then says that it's been there for 2 years. Anyway, they're not getting any hard fruit or flowers for 2 years. It gets 5 hours of sun each day in the summer, but shaded in the afternoon. Wondering, if it's only 2 years old, should that be fruiting and flowering at this point, or what can they do?
It may not be mature enough, as we just mentioned. The you know, newly planted plants, they're growing roots the first couple of years. So, you know, it's the saying, the first year it sleeps, the second year it creeps, the third year it leaps. So I wouldn't worry until after 3 or 4 years that you're not getting anything. So often people want to say, oh, what do I need to fertilize with? What is the soil missing or whatever? Rarely is there enough of any kind of a nutrient deficiency in the soil to prevent flowering and fruiting. It's almost always something else, most often light conditions, or if the plant itself isn't even growing much, then it might be something like a hard pan soil that the roots aren't able to grow out in there. But, you know, throwing fertilizer at plants is not the way to get them to flower and fruit. So I would give it another year or so. And then the question is also, is the plant growing itself? Because if that plant's not putting on adequate growth and getting bigger each, you know, then that tells me that maybe there is something wrong with the soil. Maybe the pH is way out of whack. Maybe it's, like I say, a hard pan soil and the roots aren't able to expand or something like that. But if you're getting foliage and you're getting growth, then I would give it another year or two.
Okay. Barb in Milwaukee, you are next. Go right ahead.
Hi. I've been growing kale for a few years now, and I've noticed last year and this year that they get terrible powdery mildew, and I'm growing them in different places. But I've removed the leaves. So two questions. I removed the powdery mildew leaves. I'm wondering what to do with those, because in Milwaukee, we're not supposed to throw away plants. We're supposed to keep them in the yard. And the second thing is, how can I keep, kind of fend off this powdery mildew from coming and attacking my fall crop every year?
So powdery mildew is a tough one because it's a fungus, but whereas most fungus like wet leaves and free water, powdery mildew likes not wet leaves, but high humidity and warmth. And there's a lot of different strains of powdery mildew. So the powdery mildew that attacks your bee balm is genetically different than the one that gets your lilacs, which is genetically different than the one that gets your peonies, which is genetically different than the one that gets your kale. But if you have powdery mildew, what that's telling you is that conditions are right. Those powdery mildew spores are in the air all the time, and they're coming from, I always like to blame Minnesota, but they're coming from, you know, wherever. So it's really, really hard to avoid it. Okay. So the things that are recommended are to make sure that you have good air circulation. But you know, when we get 90 and humid in Wisconsin summers, that's just perfect conditions for this stuff. And we can't really control that short of, you know, putting an air conditioner in the garden and blowing that humid air away. There are some, the thing is, once you get it, powdery mildew, you could dig a little hole in the corner of your garden and bury that stuff. You're right. You're not supposed to throw it in the landfill. But you could bury it in the soil, and those spores will, they overwinter on plant debris, but once they're buried, they're not going to come out. It's not a soil-borne fungus like early blight or something like that. So you could bury it. If you have a little campfire or something, you can throw them on there. Okay. You got to be careful of your neighbors and burning restrictions and stuff like that. So those are your options. If you have a few and you hide them in your garbage, you know, that's not something I would turn you in for, but, it's not one that even if you threw them on your compost pile or whatever, it's not going to make a difference on whether or not you have it next year, because powdery mildew is everywhere. And so it's not one that I would be horribly worried about quarantining. There is some, with kale, it's kind of hard. If it's ornamental kale, that's one thing. If it's kale you want to eat, that's another thing as far as what you would put on it to prevent it. There is some baking soda mixture with a little bit of horticultural oil that you can spray on. So if it's an ornamental kale, you could spray that. And the thing is that with anything, whether it's your cucumbers or squash or whatever, you have to treat it before you start seeing symptoms. And that's going to be by mid to late June. Once we start getting that warmer, humid air, that's when powdery mildew is happening. By the time you see the white fuzzy stuff, it's been on those plants for a while. And fungicides of any kind, whether they're something like baking soda or a purchased product, are preventative. They're not cures. So they have to be on the leaves when the spores land on the leaves, and it stops them from germinating and taking hold. So I don't have a really good answer for you again, which is why you're calling, right? If there were easy answers out there, we wouldn't need this show. Like I said, disposing of them, you can bury them. Especially if you dig a foot deep and bury diseased plants, that's for the most part. But it is always good to know what the disease is and where it wants to live.
Well, good luck, Barb. It's really difficult, especially when you grow something to eat. And I mean, I know you can eat the kale with the powdery mildew if you really, really, really wash it well. But, that's, Yeah. So back with us from the western part of the state is Diana Althwith. She's a retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. What gardening questions are on your mind? Join in by calling 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us today because coming up in the last 30 minutes of the show, we're going to hear from James Card. He's the author of a really fun book that looks at chainsaws. But right now we're taking your general gardening questions, and let's go right to a email. Mark says his lilacs are 35 plus years old, four different varieties, and they've gone from looking really good to looking very sparse by midsummer, and they have bare branches. He's seen some mole tunnels developing in the area over the last 5 years. Do they hurt lilac growth? Are they getting a little less sun each year because of the large oak tree? Or they are, but the tree has always been there. Any comments from you on that, Diana?
Sure. So lilacs tend to do that. So first, the moles are not hurting them. Moles are meat eaters. They eat grubs and worms and slugs and pupa and things like that. So they're not bothering the shrubs. 35 years old, lilacs get tall and they shade themselves out. And so that's why the lower part of the branches lose their leaves and stuff, because that part's not getting any sun anymore. The oak tree, yes, it may have been there, but I'm going to guess it too has expanded in 35 years and creating more shade. And that does make the lilac plants then reach for the sun and not flower as much. So those are all considerations. The good news is that lilacs can be rejuvenated. It's intriguing that you're having a chainsaw discussion coming up, because I will say that last year I got a battery-powered steel brand chainsaw. That is my favorite toy in the whole wide world. It has changed how I can maintain things. And you can take your little chainsaw and go into those lilacs. And again, what we're looking at is that rule of thirds. So look at your big old 35-year-old lilacs and look at the trunks, the stems going down, and cut one third of the biggest, fattest ones all the way to the ground. And then you can nip off a little bit here or there of what's left if you want. But cutting it down to the bottom is going to encourage new shoots to come up out of the roots. Next year, you do the same thing. And then the next year, you do the same thing. So in 3 years, you will basically have a whole brand new shrub with none of that old, long, tall, sparse stuff. Okay, so you can rejuvenate those shrubs and get them looking a whole lot better. Now, the other side is, if that oak tree is giving it a lot of shade, then they're still not going to be happy, because lilacs do like full sun. The other thing that we've had with lilacs across the state in the last 8-10 years is a lot of foliar problems. Dr. Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic has identified it as Septoria leaf spot. It's out there. And so what happens is that by the end of summer, leaves are turning brown, they're falling off. And this, I have it. And certain varieties, the old-fashioned lilacs get it. My newer varieties, my Tinkerbell and Fairy Tale series lilacs, don't seem to have a problem with it. But if you have a variety that has that, chances are you're going to continue to have it, especially if we have a wet, cool spring, because that really gets that fungus happy. So, that's when we start getting that decision of, if that oak tree is really shading these out, and you're getting Septoria leaf spot, which would be worse in the shade because the sun doesn't dry the leaves off, right? Maybe cutting those lilacs down all the way to the ground and pulling the roots out so they don't shoot back, and planting something else there, like a viburnum that can handle more shady conditions or something, is your better choice. So those are all things to consider in this situation. Yeah.
But try the cutting down first, Chris, the pruning hard, and hopefully that'll help them out. So, or actually it wasn't Chris, it was Mark. So anyway, let's go to Maggie in McFarland next. Go ahead, Maggie.
Hi there. I was calling about my persimmon trees. I grew up in California and love the persimmons out there. And then I decided to have some here in Madison, Wisconsin area. So I was at the Gurney's website and they had some that were hardy. And I planted them many years ago, probably about 10 years ago. And I have yet to see a single blossom on them. They're planted in a nice sunny space on a hill, and they are with my other fruit trees, like my contender peach, which is doing well, and my Asian pear, which is doing well. But instead of producing flowers, they're sending out suckers, and I'm finding them. There's a wood chip pile within about 10 feet of them, and they are growing through the wood chip pile. New trees, but never have I seen a blossom on them.
Wow, sounds like my pawpaw experiment.
Okay, so first off, I'm going to say I don't have any experience with persimmons. They're not commonly grown in Wisconsin. They're, you know, I always think of them as an Eastern U.S. kind of a thing, but I do believe that the trees are hardy. Okay. But what I don't know for sure is like when they blossom. So the first thing that pops into my mind is that they like apricot trees, the trees are hardy here, but they bloom early in the season. So the flowers are often killed by a late spring frost. And so you can only expect to get fruit like every 4 to 5 years. The other thing that I am suspicious of, and I should look it up here quick, is I think persimmons are dioecious, meaning there's male trees and female trees. And I'm just wondering if maybe you have a male tree and so that you don't have it. Now, if you got it from Gurney's, I would think that that would be, you know, not the case, because they would be providing you either the female. But even if you have the female, maybe you need a, but if you're not even getting flowers, it wouldn't be a pollination issue. So I don't know what to tell you. Again, I don't have any experience with persimmons, but and then the suckering thing is, I mean, that makes me worry about some kind of a invasiveness, in an area, that sort of thing. I don't have an answer for you. but as we talked earlier, you know, it's not usually a thing of, oh, you need some kind of fertilizer to make them flower. That's not likely. You know, Wisconsin has super fertile soils, and there's rarely going to be a spot in Wisconsin where there's a soil that's totally missing some nutrient that, you know, would cause a plant to not grow. So you might do a soil test just to make sure. You know, you said that your peach trees and stuff are doing fine, so I doubt you have any kind of a soil issue. I just don't know why, if it's been in the ground that long, it doesn't want to flower. And since they flower early in the season, it would be interesting to go out there, look up what a flower bud looks like versus a leaf bud, and see if there are any flower buds on them now, because that could tell you that, well, they're trying, but something is damaging those flower buds over winter. And
I wonder if she could even contact the company she got them from, if they could give her a heads up on anything too. That might help. So, well, good luck, Maggie. I wish you luck because it's a really beautiful fruit. So let's go to Margaret in Hustisford next. Go ahead, Margaret.
Hi, good morning. First, I'll offer what I do know about the persimmon. Unless it's the Asian variety, they need a male-female in order to pollinate.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, and then my question is, I have a dittany or a gas plant. I've never cut it back, and it's done well, which is a miraculous thing. But what do you recommend for cutting or back or pruning? And it's still good waxy leaves, and even the seed buds still have fragrance. And then my other question is controlling the tubular clematis.
Okay. What you got for us, Diana?
So the question was, should you cut back the gas plant or?
When and how, I guess.
When and how. You know, that's the kind of thing that, again, you don't have to cut things back unless you're trying to control it. So if you need to control its size or growth habit or whatever, then you can prune that back probably at any time. And just, you know, to get it to shaped and the space that you need it to be in. So that's, they're not super picky about that. And the other question I'm sure, sorry, was?
Margaret, what was that about the hydrangea? No.
No, controlling the
clematis.
Controlling the spread of the tubular clematis.
Oh, the clematis, yeah. Okay.
So the clematis, right, you know, it's going to want to spread. There are different kinds of clematis. The non-climbing tube, the tube clematis doesn't really climb so much. It just gets erect stems and then it spreads out. So that's one where it's just... you can't prevent it from wanting to spread. So you have to just keep whacking back the spreading that it's doing.
Okay.
You can't stop it from spreading. Sometimes you can like mulch super heavily and then it tends to, you know, it's just like so many of the root spreading things that are, like raspberries and whatever, they're going to want to spread because that's their natural habit to do. So it's, just kind of continuing to whack it back to keep it in your space that you want.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Margaret. And Rana, you're in Cameron. You're in next. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I was recently gifted some hollyhock seeds. I'm really excited about them. I'm willing to take a gamble. I want to put them in the ground or on top of the ground and seed them in and cover them. And I've never had good luck, so I'm thinking, hey, you know, what's one more failure with these hollyhocks? I'm looking for any tips or tricks you could give me.
Diana, we only have about a minute before we have to go for a break.
Okay, so hollyhocks aren't difficult. The thing is, I would wait until spring. Prepare your soil, you know, nice soil, fluff it up a little bit, put the seeds down, cover them about a quarter of an inch, and so they have good seed to soil contact, and then just kind of keep them damp but not waterlogged until they germinate. They do need some light to germinate, so don't bury them too deep, just a very thin layer of soil over the top. The thing is that they take 10 to 20, maybe, you know, a good 3-4 weeks before they'll germinate. So keep them moist in that amount of time, for that length of time. Don't like water them and then let them dry out. And they should grow. They're pretty happy to grow that way.
All right. Well, good luck, because I know once you get them established, they're great. But until then, it's a little tricky. So we'll be back to take more of your questions and emails after this look at the news. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Joan LeJoe, and back with us today is Diana Offuth. She is a retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. Make sure to stay with us, because coming up at 12:30, we'll talk, or I should say in the last half hour of the show, if you're listening on Saturday, we'll talk about a very useful gardening tool with James Card. He's the author of a new book. It's called Chainsaw Love, Field Notes on the World's Most Dynamic Power Tool. But first, are you struggling to figure out what perennials to maybe cut back or how to keep them going through the winter? Why don't you give us a call? The number, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Diana, before we go back to the phones, we did get an email from Bill in Oregon, who says that grafted persimmon trees will flower in 3 to 7 years. Seed-grown persimmon trees require 10 to 15 years to start flowering. He also says pawpaw trees take 3 to 8 plus years, depending on their location. And yes, that is true. And that they're happier in the shade, but take longer to start flowering. So don't give up on your persimmons. At 10 years, they might be on the cusp. So thank you, Bill.
Oh, that is really interesting. Well, thank you for sending us that info, because that's what we need, somebody who actually knows these plants.
That's right. That's right.
And I have no persimmon experience. So that's interesting. Yeah. And it's interesting, if hers was sending up suckers, then that's, you know, those, if it was a grafted tree, those suckers will be different than the main tree. Interesting.
Well, interesting information there. Thank you so much, Bill. Also, one of the things we wanted to talk about today is wrapping trees. Now, I've been driving past some houses, and some of their shrubs are wrapped. Is that a good thing to do? And if that's the case, is it, should we do it now? What should we use, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a great question. So wrapping shrubs is typically for evergreens, and that's to keep the dry, cold winter winds from hitting the needles and drying them out, like we were talking about earlier, because again, these plants can't replace that moisture when the ground is frozen. So if you have some things like yews, junipers, that are in arborvitae, that are in a place where they get a lot of winter wind or winter sun, because that sun can also warm those needles up enough and then they lose moisture. Wrapping them so that they're not brown in the springtime is not a bad idea. We don't typically do that for deciduous kinds of plants, but yes, now would be the time to do it, because it's the end of November already. And, you know, the weather can change very quickly here. The other thing, though, and I'm glad this came up, is wrapping trees. So any kind of young trees, if you have especially a maple, because they have smooth, thin bark, if you have a tree that's less than 6 inches in diameter, or I would wrap it. And the best thing to do is to use something that's white. There are tree wraps that are like a spiral plastic thing. Those are my favorite, because they're easy on, easy off, and you can reuse them. And what we're trying to do is to keep the sun from warming that trunk. So what happens is, in, you know, like mid, late February, the sun's starting to get stronger, and there's usually snow, and that sun reflects up off of the snow and onto those trunks, and it warms the bark. And then the cells under there start becoming a little active, and then the sun goes down and it's 10 below and those cells burst and break. And that's how we get wounds on the south and southwest sides of trunks. And maples are notorious for it, but apple trees, cherry trees, anything that's got a smooth, thin bark, the first, you know, several years, you really do need to do that. And that should be done this weekend as well. If you don't have those plastic things, you know, there's that paper, it's brown paper, that isn't as effective because it can warm right through that. But if you have some leftover light colored latex paint, you can wrap it with paper and then paint that paper to help reflect off the heat of the sun. Or if you have a lot of trees and you can't wrap them all, just take that paint and paint the trunks white to reflect off some of the heat of the sun. And that's what big nurseries do.
I've never heard that one before. But the plastic wrap is a good thing we need to mention, too. If you've got those skinny trees, the rabbits and everything else that'll chew on that, it helps to keep them away, too. So I've used that
a lot. And make sure that you get it all the way to the ground for those voles and stuff. Yeah. That's another issue and another reason to be
wrapping. I've spent a lot of money on trees that were eaten because I didn't do that. So, please do that. Okay, let's go back to the phones. We've got Liz in Madison with a question. Go right ahead.
Hi. I have been struggling to get rid of black cohosh in my garden. I planted it in the wrong spot. It's in a full sun spot, and it is thriving. It does get kind of those brown leaves towards the end of summer, which are kind of unsightly. But I just want it gone so that I can put something else there. How would you best go about sort of sadly getting rid of it?
So it might be spreading by seeds and it might be spreading by roots. So how to get rid of any plant, and I'm sure you'd rather not spray them with an herbicide. The thing is that you have to just like starve it out. So anytime that you see any of them, anytime there are leaves collecting sun, they're feeding the roots. And that's going to make them grow and spread and continue and stuff. So you should whack them off anytime you see even a leaf forming so that it's not replenishing energy into the roots. You can do that with a weed whacker. You can pull them out, that sort of a thing. You can also smother things. If you have enough of something for mulch, if you think that they're growing by seeds, if you mulch that area with 5 to 6 inches of some kind of mulch, that will keep the seeds from sprouting. So that is, not always easy depending on the size of the space and what you have available for mulch. But getting rid of anything that wants to invade like this, it's a matter of starving out the roots and keeping new seeds from sprouting. So it's going to be an ongoing battle.
Yeah, be patient because it'll be worth it if you don't like it. So good luck, Liz. Jan in Appleton, you are up next. Go right ahead.
Yesterday, a friend and I planted daffodil bulbs and I think narcissus. And the directions on the package said to water them in. But my friend said, don't water them because the ground is going to freeze and they'll just rot with the water in there. Should I water them in today or not water them?
Water them. So the ground isn't going to, you put those bulbs a couple of inches deep, right? And even though we get freezing air temperatures, it takes a while for the frost to go down that deep. And in the meantime, those bulbs are going to be growing little roots. And that's why we plant them in the fall, because while the soil is still not frozen down there, little roots are growing out of those bulbs. So they need that water to happen. The other thing is, once the ground does freeze, they won't rot because they're frozen. So it's just like you put something in your freezer, your meat in your freezer doesn't rot because it's frozen. So rotting because the ground is about to freeze is not really a concern. But you, just like we were talking earlier, everything needs to be hydrated going into winter. And then those bulbs will have that water available to grow and produce beautiful flowers next spring. So go out and water them in.
Thank you for that question, Jan. We got a question from Chris in Manitowoc. Chris grows tomatoes in big pots and had a great summer this year. Now they're going to clean out the pots. They took off 3 to 4 inches of soil and put it into the compost. Can you reuse the soil that's left in the pots next spring by adding to it to fill it up?
Yes, you can, to a certain extent. So you can reuse some potting soil by just amending it for several years. What I would do next year would be to put some compost or fresh potting soil in and mix it all up and then you can use it. What happens with potting soil over time is it breaks down and it gets into finer and finer pieces, and then it becomes where it either holds too much water or won't absorb water at all, but it can turn into like a muck that you can get, you know, root rot problems and stuff. So I usually recommend that every 3 years at least, you dump the whole thing out into the compost pile and start fresh. And, you know, the other question always comes in, you know, if you had any diseases in there. And with tomatoes, that's a concern. But if you took off the top few inches, you're probably fine. So yeah, you can reuse it at least somewhat.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone. Charlie in Beaver Dam. Go right ahead.
Hi. I have a Honeycrisp tree, approximately 4 years old, maybe five. I never pruned it. I had like five, six apples last year. This year I had 50 apples at least. I made the mistake of not spraying it for with an insecticide. What do you recommend if I need to prune it back, or and what to use for an insecticide?
All right. So it is a good idea for apples for you to do some pruning over winter for branch structure, because otherwise eventually that tree is going to get really thick and full inside. So look up how to prune an apple tree and at least go and whack out anything that's like crossing branches or branches that are growing straight up, that sort of thing. What that also does is it promotes air circulation through the canopy of the tree, so then you'll have less fungal disease issues in there. As for insecticides, what you're going to do is you're going to go on the internet and you're going to go UW Extension, Apple Pest Management for Homeowners. Okay. It's an extension publication and it explains the pests and what to do and when, because it's timing is everything. In Wisconsin, we have one main fungus, which is apple scab. Honeycrisp isn't really affected by that too much, so you may not need to worry about a fungicide at all. But there's two insects that cause the majority of apple problems, apple maggot and codling moth. They come out at different times of the year, and there's different ways you need to control them. So codling moth is earlier in the year. Apple maggot doesn't come out until like July. So spraying an insecticide for apple maggot in June is useless because the insects aren't around yet. So they come out in July. But if you look at this, that publication, Apple Pest Management for Homeowners, it will tell you the timing and what you would need to spray and when to control that. The other thing is, if you only are worried about getting 50 apples for fresh eating, you can put little plastic bags around each little apple when it's the size of a nickel, and then you can stop any insects and disease spores from getting to them. So that's another thing you can check out. But there's not an easy, simple, or one-time spray for getting insect-free apples. You have to spray multiple times at the right time for the insect that you're dealing with.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. David in Sturgeon Bay, you are next. Go right ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. You had just mentioned about refreshing potting soil in houseplants, and you know, I've got about a 14-foot tall fig tree in a living room. And it's in, I cut open a 55-gallon drum and put it in there and blah, blah, blah. Long and short of it is it's probably got 20 years of soil in there. It seems to be doing well, but it is getting very broken down. So how do I mean, is it a tree that big or something? Will I disturb it more and harm it more by trying to get off the soil, or is it still better to try to refresh that soil?
David, what kind of fig tree are you talking about? Like a fiddly fig or a ficus?
Yes, a fiddly.
A fiddly?
Yeah,
okay.
A fiddly.
All right. Diana?
So that sounds like an amazing planting. You obviously have high living room ceilings. So if you have a 14-foot tall tree, if the plant is doing well, I tend to say just don't, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Having said that, what you can do is just to make sure that that soil has as much, you know, all of the nutrients that are needed. Obviously, you must be fertilizing it at some point. You are right. If you go to trying to dig out soil and replace some soil just because, you can do a lot of damage to the roots. And then, oh my gosh, I can't imagine the effort that it would take with a plant that big. So you can always put a little bit, as that soil breaks down, if it's sinking at all, you can just top dress it, scratch into the surface as much as you can, and then just put a little bit of fresh potting mix on top. And, you know, that might help to counteract any of the breakdown that's going in there. But man, I not try to worry about the soil if everything is going fine.
David, we were talking about outdoor, like tomatoes, not inside plants. So that there's a difference there, isn't there?
Right. Being a perennial plant, the fig tree inside, if it's happy, I have a big jade tree, and the thing is like almost 3 feet tall now, and I just repotted it into a bigger pot because it was in a really tiny one, like 2 months ago. And yesterday I noticed that it's getting flower buds. And this plant, you know, I've had it probably 15 years and it's never flowered before. So suddenly it's deciding to flower and I'm not exactly sure why. But if your plant is looking like it's not doing great and you wanted to up pot it, that's one thing, and that's the time to add some new soil. But I don't think I would fiddle with it. I wouldn't fiddle with your fig, you know.
No pun intended. Yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, David, because you are obviously doing a very good job. Let's get back in the last few minutes here to, you know what? I've got one more email I haven't had a chance to talk about. Mark in La Crosse emailed that he has 3 9 barks that are 15 years old. He maintains them at a height of about 4 feet. Now, in recent years, they've become less full, and it's difficult for him to determine the live from the dead stems when he's pruning it, and it's also susceptible to powdery mildew. How and when do you recommend pruning to promote more vigorous growth that will give it a fuller look?
Yeah, so that's another one, like we talked about the lilacs. 9 barks can get rejuvenated by pruning all the way down to the ground. So the biggest, oldest stems, whether they're dead or alive, go in and prune out a third of those. And then I'm guessing that yours is probably the Diablo 9 bark, if it's a burgundy leaved one, because those are the ones that are really susceptible to powdery mildew and get about that height. So I've actually have a Diablo, and probably every 5 years I pretty much whack it down to the ground to about a foot tall, because it's growing in a spot that it's getting bigger than it was supposed to, because there's a rain gutter that goes down there that gets too much water. I would whack those biggest ones down all the way to the ground, and that's going to encourage new fuller growth from the base. And, you know, I would tell you that you should do the never more than a third at a time. That's the horticulturist in me telling you that. But I'll also tell you that if you do more than that, it's not going to kill the plant. And then as far as controlling the powdery mildew, we talked about powdery mildew earlier, and it's just hard. It's something that these things are likely going to get in. Fortunately, it's mostly cosmetic, but it will cause tip dieback and branch dieback on these 9 barks. So promoting air circulation by letting it not be too full helps. And, if you want to look at some kind of a powdery mildew spray or something on them, you could look into that. But again, start early in the year.
And he wants them full, and that's going to even promote more powdery mildew. So
right.
I guess maybe a happy medium, Mark. Thank you. One last thing. peonies. Do we cut them back or do we leave them? Now, I leave mine because, like I said before, lazy. But my friend Debbie cuts hers down. It's immaculate, and hers always look way better than mine do in the summer. So what should we do with those peonies?
You know, that's back again to it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
Because what's above ground is, like mine, I didn't cut them back, but they have, you know, once they freeze and stuff, they fall over, you know, and then they eventually break off and whatever. So it's like the equivalent of being cut back. But it's going to look a little neater going into winter. Those are ones that don't stand up and provide winter interest. They flop out and fall over. Hers might look better because they get more sun, or they have different soil, or they're a different variety, or, you know, there might be a whole lot of other reasons. With peonies, I would say there's no reason to keep them because, again, they're not providing winter interest or bird food or stuff like that. But if you don't get to it.
Bottom of the list. Yeah. Now, one thing that we've had questions about before is lavender. And I don't know if lavender does well by you in the kind of driftless area or not. But should you cut it back? Should you just leave it? I usually leave mine and cut it and wait until it comes back, because sometimes it looks dead and it's not. Is that been your experience, Diana?
So lavender, we're kind of right on the edge. We do have the growing. There's some newer varieties that are hardier now, so we are getting lavender in the area, even though, you know, it's 10 years ago there really wasn't. But you're right. Lavender wants to overwinter. And so it's kind of like Russian sage. So Russian sage is another one that farther south, it's actually a shrub, but up here we treat it as a perennial. And so I would not cut it back because it's one of those that if we knew for sure what our winter was going to be like,
right?
We would, right? Because if it's a winter that where we get snow before we get super cold, the bottom part of that plant might survive. And then, like you say, it'll leaf out above ground. So if we cut that off now, we're losing that. So by waiting till spring and waiting to see what's sprouting, you're not cutting away something that would otherwise make it. If we don't have snow and we have a really cold winter, it may die back further. And that's my advice for things like clematis, hydrangea, you know, some of these plants, if winter's not bad, they will leaf out from above ground old wood. If it's a worse winter, they'll die back further. So if we just wait and see, that's another reason to not cut everything back now and just wait until spring, cut away whatever's dead once new growth starts. And that's kind of how I, you know, do those questionable things. Just wait and see what nature does for the year.
That sounds like a perfect way to end this show. Thank you once again for sharing all of your expertise with us, Diana.
Well, you're welcome. It's great to be here, and I'm looking forward to hearing about chainsaws in the next half hour because, like I said, those are awfully handy tools, especially now that you don't have to have the gas and have to pull them.
Yes.
Really handy. So,
all right. Well, thank you again. And we'll have you back again soon. And as Diana had said, we are going to be talking to the author of the new book about chainsaws. So please stick around with us and we'll be back in just a bit. Well, chainsaws are a very powerful tool to have in the garden, whether it's trimming branches or removing entire trees. But have you ever stopped to think about how a chainsaw works or the part it played in logging our forests? Well, our next guest has, and he's here to share some of his observations. This is Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And with us is James Card. He has written for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Foreign Policy, and other national publications, and is the only journalist in history to have stories about ice fishing and deer hunting on the front page of the New York Times. Can you tell he's from Wisconsin? Between stints as a magazine editor and journalist, James worked as a line clearance tree faller. His book is called Chainsaw Love, Field Notes on the World's Most Dynamic Power Tool. Are you a chainsaw fan? Do you have questions on how to better utilize one that you probably have in your gardening shed? Or do you need some advice on finding the best kind for your needs? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. James, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jill. It's good to be here.
You bet. Now, as I had told you earlier, this was near and dear to my heart since my dad sold chainsaws for years and years and years. So I kind of have a little bit of a background on it. But I have to mention that your title, Chainsaw Love, it sounds like it could be a Hallmark Christmas movie. Where did the name come from?
Maybe from the song Radar Love.
Okay.
I guess I had that in my head at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love it. So who did you write this book for?
Well, it was, there's a bit of advice. It's write the book that you want to read. And I wanted to read about chainsaws, and there's not much out there for chainsaw literature except for how-to and prescriptive type books. Mm-hmm. There's a few books on chainsaw carving. There's a few books on basic operations and the mechanics of tree felling and things like that. But I wanted to read more broadly about chainsaws. There's one really good book about chainsaw history, which I used as a source in my book about historical aspects of the saw. And that's about it. There's really not much else out there. At one time, there was a magazine called Chainsaw World that lasted for a few decades, but it no longer exists. So I wrote something that I would like to read about chainsaws.
All right.
So
well, that makes a lot. About. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, after reading this book, I have to say that you obviously do love chainsaws. How did this affair start with you?
I grew up with my father cutting firewood and always had this interest and fascination about it. And like you mentioned, you said your father was a chainsaw dealer.
Mm-hmm.
My father took me to a place up in Black River Falls called Wood Sales and Service. And they were the main chainsaw dealer in like Jackson and La Crosse County, that neck of the woods of Wisconsin. And I was really fascinated by him. It was a really cool place to go as a little boy, looking at these mean machines. And then from there, I became an adult. I had a, backyard, and I had a chainsaw to just do simple cleanups from storms and things like that. But two things later combined in my adult life was getting a wood stove. And also, in between journalism jobs, I worked as a line clearance tree trimmer. And it was then when I really realized how important the chainsaw is in so many things in the world, not just logging. Obviously, chainsaws revolutionized the world of logging. But in line clearance tree trimming, we're working next to distribution lines and transmission lines that carry electricity to the world. And the number one thing that creates blackouts are trees hitting the lines. And our job is to remove all the hazardous trees that are leaning out and growing towards them. One of the biggest, I think the biggest blackout in American history was in, I think it was 2003, and it knocked out a good chunk of the East Coast. So it's serious business. So without these crews of guys out there with chainsaws beating back Mother Nature every single day, we would be living in a world of constant electrical blackouts. And that's what kind of gave me the idea to maybe write something a little bit deeper about chainsaws.
Yeah, that that chapter in your book I found very interesting. I guess you don't think about all this work that people do because it just, like you said, we don't have the blackouts because people are doing all this wonderful work. It is very dangerous what they do when they clear out the trees and brush underneath those lines, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's logging, I believe, is one of the always ranked every year as one of the most dangerous occupations in America.
Right.
And then another one is linemen, mm-hmm. Guys that climb the power line poles and work with the lines. And we're kind of a mix of that. The trouble is when you're felling a tree, you can't just flop it anywhere.
No.
You have to be constantly aware of that power line and how to safely drop the tree in a semi-parallel-ish way with the line. And that can be really tricky because the conditions are constantly changing. We always have ropes up in the trees, and there's a person with a rope pulling it in the direction that we want it to drop. And we get tons of training. There's a giant manual that we have to study and pass to kind of move up the ranks in that occupation. So there's constant kind of bookwork and hands-on training. I got trained in CPR multiple times, and the safety is just drilled right into all of us on that type of job.
What are some of the more common mistakes that some of us weekend warriors can make when we're handling a saw?
Safety gear, you got to wear it. Chaps are the biggest thing. Everybody should have chaps when they're using a chainsaw. That is the most common area where people get hurt because often you're cutting down by your leg area. You're leaning down with the saw and something happens and you nick your leg. So chaps are essential. And then, of course, safety glasses. You got sawdust flying everywhere, so that's obvious. And then gas-powered chainsaws, they're loud. They're two-stroke engines, super loud, so you wear your protection. Also, gloves are important, too. There are cut-proof gloves that I suggest every chainsaw owner should have. They're made out of, like, this woven Kevlar material. And you still might get hurt because there's different levels of the cut protection. And so it just gets a medium level protection gloves. They're kind of knitted. Some are kind of stretchy with a rubberized grip, but that will save you some bloodshed.
And that goes for those little electric saws as well as the great big gas powered ones, right?
Yeah, if you're using a big, great, big gas-powered one, you should be wearing chaps and all the safety gear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With the small gas-powered or the electrical saws, now, this deal in the world of chainsaws is going electric. I think for people that previously never were hesitant about using chainsaws, this is like your entry into this.
Yes, it is.
It's a gateway drug. So the little lithium battery ones, they're really slick. They are fantastic for backyard people and gardeners and great for doing little things. And, of course, you should still wear your protective gear. You got, again, sawdust flying everywhere. However, they're really quiet, so you don't need ear protection. It's kind of like a sound of a bunch of hornets, I guess, a bunch of bees buzzing around. But, yeah, you should still have chaps that can save you from a lot of hurt.
For sure. So, we're talking with James Card about his new book, Chainsaw Love, Field Notes on the World's Most Dynamic Power Tool. Are you a chainsaw fan? What do you love about them? What questions do you have for James? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, and you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Joan Legeau. Join us again on Monday. Larry's going to be back to talk to Dr. Zorba about holiday cooking. Take your health questions, too. And to top that all off, we're going to hear from the weather guys. So it should be a altogether fun show. Right now, we are talking about the book Chainsaw Love, Field Notes on the World's Most Dynamic Power Tool. And James, we have a question from James. He emailed to ask, are you aware of anyone who will repair a 1970s era steel 041 farm boss saw?
Yes, I do. He's featured in a chapter in my book. His name's Dan Stuckman. He's over in Manitowoc, and I interviewed him. He was gracious enough to let me in his home and down to his basement workshop and out into his garage and out into his tool shed, where he has hundreds of chainsaws of all kinds of makes, models, and vintage. And as far as I can tell, Dan is the number one chainsaw restoration guy in the state of Wisconsin, if not even the Midwest or maybe in the United States. His expertise is really incredible. He's able to get a chainsaw that's been sitting in a barn for the last 40 years, all rusty, and bring it back to life.
That's amazing. You have a few interesting characters in your book. That being said, we've talked a little bit about what's in it, but what else can people find in it when they're reading it?
Well, another interesting character is Mr. Howell. He was an entertainer at the Tommy Bartlett Show in the Wisconsin Dells, and he juggled chainsaws.
Yeah, crazy.
And I was able to interview him. Wisconsin has a really rich chainsaw culture, and that's why it was cool to write to, and also the publisher, the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It was a good fit for them. But anyhow, Mr. Howell, somebody somewhere said they seen a guy juggling chainsaws, and he was a juggler. And he has a background in like circus entertainment and things like that. And so he took it as a personal challenge. So he got some small size saws and they were too heavy. So he had a machine shop cut holes in the bar to lighten them. And then he affixed baseball bat handles to the ends of the power heads. So he had something to, you know, grab a hold of when he's flipping them around. And he did it. He was able to keep three chainsaws flipping up in the air. And it took him a while to master it, but he was able to pull it. And he's probably one of the few people in the world to do that athletic feat.
Yes, because, I mean, even with the holes in the bar, it's still going to be an awful heavy thing to be throwing around. So you have a picture of that in the book. So if someone wants to really to see that, they should definitely check that out. You do a really good job of covering the history of chainsaws.
Well, it's a little tricky because it's a lot like the automobile.
Yeah.
When people think of the automobile, they think immediately of Henry Ford. And he didn't invent it. He just streamlined the factory production of automobiles. Whereas there were inventors and tinkerers all over the world working on the so-called horseless carriage. Well, it was the same thing with saws. Everyone was trying to come up with this concept of what they called the endless saw, where it's a vision of a saw in constant motion powered by a machine. And some of them were kind of like a modern-day bandsaw, where it was this big band going in circles. But a lot of these contraptions, they were so large and cumbersome, you couldn't really get them effectively out into the woods. They were enormous. They were wheeled out on carts, and they just weren't practical. And it took many years for the saw to get reduced down to a size that could be used by one person. But before then, they were used by two people. So imagine a modern chainsaw, and at the very end of the bar, there's a guard and a handle. So one person is on the power head. That's where the throttle would be. And then the other person is on the other end of the bar, kind of holding it steady. And this is a bar that's like 5 feet long. And the power head weighs, you know, probably 50 pounds. And that's how a two-man crew would go into the woods and use these early prototypes. Eventually, Andre Steele in Germany, and Steele is the name of the company or the chainsaw manufacturer that's around today. They're probably, between them and Husqvarna, they're the two main chainsaw manufacturers in the world. Well, Andre Steele, he's the guy that pulled it all together and got the chainsaw sized down into a one operator unit. And then from then on, it was full on. It'd be the equivalent of like Bill Gates coming up with Windows operating system.
Yeah.
Before then, computers were kind of nerdy and not too many people used them, just scientists and, sure, you know, academics. But Windows brought computing to the people. And it was the same thing. Once that chainsaw got sized down into a one-person operating unit, then it just took off. They got better. They got smaller. There's all kinds of safety features and refinements. And then the loggers that were the first early adopters of saws, they're like, hey, this is pretty handy. I'm going to buy one and take one home with me. And then farmers and all rural type people started buying them. And that would be around the 1950s and 60s. And then by the 70s and 80s, they were super common.
And unfortunately, now you don't see many loggers in the woods with a chainsaw. That's becoming pretty rare, that lone logger, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. I spoke with Professor Michael Demchek. He's a professor of forestry at the University of Stevens Point. They have this great College of Natural Resources up there. And I was curious on what's the role of chainsaws in modern-day logging. For decades, they were the main tool, but now not so much. Now there's these devices called feller bunchers and timber harvesters. They're tractor-like gigantic machines. Some have wheels, some have tracks, and they go into the woods, go up to a tree. They have this moving, actually quite nimble arm or boom that goes and grabs the tree, cuts it, and then it shaves off all the branches, and you move it, the log over and drop it into a pile. It's a really incredible sight. There's many YouTube videos out there where you can watch this stuff in action. And that's modern-day logging today. Mm-hmm. So where does the chainsaw fit in?
Yeah.
And it still has an important role because those machines can't get everywhere. So they call them hand cutters. That is people cutting down the trees by hand with a chainsaw. And these lumberjacks are kind of like the specialized commandos. They'll go into areas where it's steep slopes, maybe swampy, hard to reach places, or maybe it's a tree that's not growing perfectly straight. It's a big old gnarly oak tree, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where they come in. Also, they can judge the tree better on the ground for how to make the proper cuts. So you can add a lot of value to the final log product by being able to read the tree trunk and seeing where cuts should be made to extract the greatest amount of timber value from that log.
Okay.
Whereas that's difficult to see if you're in a cab with, you know, smudged up windows.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. You have some really good examples of that in the book, too. I particularly like reading about the chainsaw in popular culture. And to that, we've got Tom in Montello. Oh, I think we just lost him, unfortunately. But he had a question about the, and I think you actually address this in your book about the rock and roll song called The Lumberjack.
And, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that has a chainsaw in it. So he had a question about that. I'm not sure what the question was, but that was what he was talking about. But yeah, what are some of your favorites of chainsaws in popular culture?
Well, I don't know if I have any favorites. I mean, probably my favorite one is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. That's my favorite Christmas movie. And the chainsaw makes many appearances. And there's the scene where he comes out of the garage wearing the hockey mask and revs up his chainsaw. And that's a reference to, there's these hidden references in the movies.
Right.
In that movie. He cuts off the newel post on the stairway, and that's a reference from the other Christmas movie. It's on the tip of my tongue. But the chainsaw has become now a cliche in horror films, and that's because of the number one chainsaw movie ever, and that's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And that's the movie that really opened up the whole genre of horror and slasher films. I mean, nothing else like it had been seen before when it debuted in the early 70s. Since then, everybody now likes to throw in a chainsaw into a horror movie. And it's also appeared in gangster films like Scarface. There's a scene in the bathroom, which is, you don't see any human flesh getting mangled, but it's off the camera where it's happening, and that makes it even more terrifying.
So, yeah, it's kind of like with Psycho. You don't see it, but yeah, it's scarier that way.
Yeah, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah, the chainsaw is all over in popular culture, and it's become kind of this symbol of mayhem, of bloody destruction, and it can be. It can be a very dangerous tool. You can end up with a lot of stitches at the hospital. But one thing what's really interesting in my research is that if you're a normal person, you're not some homicidal maniac, chainsaws will not kill you in an accident. They will hurt you. You'll get some stitches, and it'll be a bloody mess, but you're probably not going to die. What's going to kill you are trees in motion. And I did a lot of research into forestry and chainsaw-related accidents. And what gets everyone are trees that are either falling, or maybe they're bouncing off the ground, or they're rolling or falling on top of a person, or maybe they are getting roped, like a rigging system that arborists would use, and that thing goes haywire and it smokes somebody. But it's this enormous amount of tree weight that ends up killing people. The chainsaws, they'll hurt you, but they're not going to send you to the grave.
Right. That's a really good point. We have run out of time, James. There was so much that we could have talked about packed into this book. I think it would make a really good Christmas present or a holiday gift for the person who loves the chainsaw in your life, right?
Yes. I mean, the winter is my favorite time to go out and cut firewood. It's the woods are clean. Everything's easy to see. And it's a great way to get some exercise on a winter day.
Yes, absolutely. And I thought one of your quotes about it being an antidote for modern vampires was wonderful. I wanted you to talk about it, but we do not have time. So if anybody wants to hear about that, you got to read the book. Thank you, James, for being with us. We really appreciate that.
Me.
You bet. We're talking about James Card's new book, Chainsaw Love, Field Notes on the World's Most Dynamic Power Tool. Thanks to our team for all the shows, including Claire Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Roberts, of course, Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thank you for being with us and enjoy your weekend.